And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
You can't put the genie back into the bottle. That's been proven time and time again. And the genie I'm referring to has the potential to grant all of our wishes and or to become the monster. The science of life is becoming now the technology of life. We've crossed an amazing threshold. We hear from the man who charted the human genome and learn where the genetic pathway may lead. And speaking of research, ever wanted to do field research in exotic places around the world? You'll find out how when your Voice of the Earth returns here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
You know, I try to keep you informed about this amazing world, and it certainly is that. Sometimes it does seem a bit dismal, but it is for much of the living world. And we are being challenged to consider a radically different future, as the specter of global warming engulfs us, and as the population sets the planet wobbling with too many people trying to hang on. For me, as a scientist and a storyteller, these are fascinating times, filled with real-life drama, villains, and hopefully, hope. What I find most interesting to watch, as we make our way through these radically changing times, is the genius of our species, that when it finds itself facing almost certain catastrophe, finds a unique and unimaginable way out. It's the basis of every James Bond film ever made. Today, oil reached $107 a barrel. And I'm afraid this is just the platform upon which a whole new era of oil prices will be built. Many people know that we're heading into the era of limited oil resources, and it is absolutely logical and rational to project that a time will come when there simply is no more usable oil. So what are we supposed to do? Humans around the world are revisioning our future. A most innovative new vision, which I ran across today, talked about a time when people will walk to work and grow their food locally. Sounds mighty good, doesn't it? And then there is another side to this story, and that's where you're about to go in just a moment. Here's a little bio fact that may change the way we think about everything. There are microbes that convert CO2 into octane chemicals, the kind that power our vehicles, but they are small and hard to find. Well, imagine that some mad scientist decided to find a way to, now listen carefully, manufacture those microbes, to mass produce its DNA, replace masses of existing cells with the octanoid's DNA, and create enough gasoline to feed our needs indefinitely. And here's a kicker. It could lead to a shortage of CO2 in time. Now imagine that. Pretty exotic, right? Wrong. Those genetic manufacturing factories may be starting up within 2 years. That story's coming up in the Weekly Earth Summit in just a moment. In segment two, we learn about a field studies program that provides hands-on research to college students in special field studies classrooms around the world. That's coming up in segment two. But now it's time for the Weekly Earth Summit. Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. I'm your host, Sydney Wildsmith, and here's where we come to hear some of the most amazing people talk about some of the greatest ideas on Earth. Today, we're in Over the Top. What you're about to hear is a discussion that is a turning point of life on Earth. Dr. Craig Venter made history when his laboratory successfully mapped the entire human genome, that is, our DNA. His historic accomplishment was part of a vast area of research that is transforming life and our future by providing hope to many whose lives will be improved through genetic implants, while others see the hand of chaos as we tinker with things we may not yet understand. What you will hear in this segment is a question and answer session that followed an address by Craig Venter about the history and approach that has led to his belief that within a relatively short time, we will be capable of mass-producing designer life forms that could, for example, produce all of the gasoline or hydrogen we need indefinitely, and quite frankly, that is only a trailhead to mountains of possibilities that are now opening. Some would say not a moment too soon, and others would say that should never, ever be breached. This is not science fiction. This is fact, which may soon turn into factories producing computer-designed living forms to help us all out. Because the first half of Dr. Venter's talk is fairly technical, I've provided it as a third segment on today's show for those who will want to understand fully what we are about to learn. So now, without further ado, we hear Dr. Craig Venter, who will be interviewed by Chris Anderson, curator of TED, following his recent presentation at a TED gathering.
Craig, you have an incredible way of just saying in a very calm way stuff that will probably change not our lives, but for our children in the world to come. Help me understand a couple of things, and we're going to have some questions from the audience in a bit, so be ready in a few minutes to put a hand up. Short, crisp questions, less than 30 seconds. You've discovered all these millions of genes and organisms in your ocean voyage, all of which do things that really we weren't aware of. Why not use some of those organisms rather than designing from scratch? Is that whole process really necessary to achieve these incredible goals you have?
It's an important question. I mean, right now we are finding a lot of biodiversity. We find organisms in the environment that actually produce octane. You grow these in the lab, they smell like a gas station or a diesel tank. But nothing ever evolved to produce the kind of quantities we need. And the scale is what's really important. So we were thinking of making micro-refineries. So if you make a micro-refinery that makes 20,000 liters a day, you need 1 million of those to match what we use in oil. So the scale is what's critical. And it's, well, metabolism can change by 1,000 to 1 million fold in the lab. It's not clear anything can really work on the scale that we need. We and others are trying to change existing organisms now. That's a stopgap to get going. The ultimate will be chemical design. We're talking to most of the chemical industry that use oil and coal as raw materials to see if it can switch capturing CO2 back in these processes. So I think we eventually have to get to biodesign. And to optimize these, we absolutely have to do that.
So there's no reason why nature itself would have produced bugs with exactly the properties that we need right now.
In fact, that's why photosynthesis is so ineffective. In fact, if things produce things on the scale we need, this would be a methane planet, for example, not a oxygen-driven one.
And so you've got this three-part process for creating synthetic life. Two of the parts are completed. The first part was you basically proved that you could move a chromosome, a natural chromosome, from one bug to another and reboot that bug.
And we've made now the chemical molecule, and they're making even larger ones. So we are now booting up the chemically made chromosome.
And that would be
that's a technical difference, but that'll be the third absolute proof of the whole process.
Right now in your lab, scientists are trying to take that huge chromosome you referred to, insert it into
another
bacteria, and hope that it boots and basically starts reproducing using that.
We try not to base too much on hope, but
how is it? Are you waiting? I mean, do you have your cell phone switched on, waiting for the call? Is this a big? Surely this is a big deal for you.
They're very slow experiments. It takes about 6 weeks or so because these cells, being so small and so limited, grow very slowly. But I think it will be exciting when that is booted up, and I'm sure it will happen this year. But there's a lot of barriers to doing this. The combinations have to be right. You have to have the right restriction enzymes. Cells, you can see maybe why they would have evolved to not want this to happen. If you can lose your entire identity just from having DNA exchange, it would change the nature of sex quite a bit.
So when that's happened, you then have this ability to, you've got your a chromosome that you can then add different design elements onto, try out different life forms. Talk to us more about that process and how it is right now. I mean, right now, is it possible on a computer to say, we think that this particular chromosome will generate a bug that does X?
Yeah, we're absolutely using software to design the pathways, the metabolic organisms, all the aspects we want in the cells, and we're building those pathways. So it is absolutely based on computer design. That even trying to change existing cells, you have to put in whole new chemical pathways. DuPont spent 10 years and about $100 million changing about 16 different genes in E. coli, where they go in massive tanks going from sugar to propane diol. We're trying to not just do it by trial and error, we're trying to do it by direct design. And I think it will change the process, change the efficiency, and get us there much faster. But think of this as an iterative process. You know, a lot of people like to think in terms of Genesis, oh, we're creating life from scratch. We're using one of the key tenets of life. All life derives from other life. We're using that 3.5 billion years of evolution. We're just trying to take it over now with new software to take it very rapidly in new directions. So the first cell, now you can design it so it can easily take new chromosomes, new material to get to the next stages. So we'll see an exponential change in the pace of the sophistication of the organisms and what they can do.
So just building on that, I mean, you had that interesting slide up saying software that creates its own hardware. Yeah. Just talk about that a bit more, because someone might say, this isn't really new synthetic life. All you're doing is you're writing code. You're making a computer disk. You're not making a computer.
We're definitely not creating life from scratch. It's an intellectual concept. We absolutely start with digital code in the computer, make that chemical molecule. We start with 4 bottles of chemicals, but we are absolutely dependent on having life evolve to this point to be able to take that software and read it. So it's like if you had a piece of software and you had no computer to read it on, it doesn't do you any good. But we can use those basic tools to get very rapidly to whole new orders of magnitude.
I mean, I understand you to say that you actually don't need to make all of life from scratch. The key thing is just to make the code, because that then does the rest of the job for you.
Exactly.
Yeah, so that's really fun. And are you using, it seems like part of the power of this is that you don't have to like design one chromosome and then do it. Part of what you're doing is creating many designs at once and throwing them out there and seeing which ones work in a controlled environment.
Yeah, because the vastness of biology, right now with a 20 million gene data set, at the pace of science, if 10,000 of those get understood in a decade, with the way science is going to be really stunning. So we have to have these combinatorial approaches. We have to have the ability to do basically millions of experiments simultaneously using empiricism. But it's all the question you ask. If you just want to see what leads to a life form growing in these conditions, that's one question. But if you're screening for new derivatives of octane to be efficiently produced, starting with CO2, and you want to know that, you can optimize for that question as well. So, like all biology, it's based on selection, and it's based either on the natural environment that you're selecting for or the constraints and questions you put on it.
So you're kind of creating your own Darwinian environment, throwing in lots of thousands, millions of competing designs and seeing which superbug comes out of it that, whoa, this thing actually gobbles up CO2 and makes energy. I mean, that's going to be a big day for mankind, isn't it?
We are doing that right now this year with pathways. So we're working with a eukaryotic system where we just make one artificial chromosome with these synthesis pathways. Once you know the 50 genes that you want in, we have for each of those 50 genes 10 to 100,000 different varieties. so we can substitute those in and try and optimize the system. So it's biology is empirical at this stage because there is so much diversity. The combinatorial computational aspects allow us to overcome that diversity.
Fantastic. Question from the audience. Chris questions. I saw this hand first.
I can make the case that you and your company are the most dangerous humans on planet Earth, because just as you have opening up the door to wonderful aspects, weaponization through the same process could doom the human species.
Is that the question?
That's the question. What do you guys do for security?
It is an important question, one that's been raised from the beginning, from the first bioethical review that suggested that we should go ahead with the caveat. Fortunately, there's not that many people on our planet wanting to do harm with these tools. A part of a review funded by the Sloan Foundation with us and MIT looked at this question and, along with the government, decided very few biological agents that we work with or even could be weaponized, would people go to this route. There's 10,000 freezers around the world with hoof and mouth disease virus in it that you wouldn't go to try and build the sophistication to do it. But it is an important issue. Every new technology has the ability to be abused.
You had on your slide, you had an intriguing little label on one of the boxes that said suicide gene. Well, what is that?
Well, we build in various levels of security with roughly 10 million experiments of people putting all kinds of different genes in E. coli over the last 30 years. There's never been one issue with it because the E. coli was modified never to survive outside the lab. So we use those as starting positions, but extra security is a suicide gene that if ever got out, you could easily trigger that and it would kill the organism. So,
but if what you're building is a 21st century version of PageMaker or something, so that in the natural consequence of all this is in 30 years' time, any grad student in their lab can build up on screen, I want this, press a button, here's my super designed, self-replicating, kill the human race bug. Aren't you creating the possibility for that to happen?
Well, it's actually, fortunately, creating pathogens is probably one of the most difficult things. Out of the repertoire of probably 50 million species on our planet, it's only a few dozen that take any interest in us, and it's even hard to understand that. There are courses now at MIT and Berkeley teaching these methods, and some are advocating biohacking. I'm not advocating biohacking, but part of what we're working with various groups on is we need new tools against emerging infections. It really doesn't matter whether they're man-made or not. We now, in this last year in this country, drug-resistant Staph aureus killed more people than HIV. That's a new emerging infection. HIV was an emerging infection. SARS was an emerging infection. And I guarantee as we go from 6.5 to 9 billion people with increased poverty, we're going to have a lot of new emerging infections. So we need new antibiotics, new antivirals, and new vaccines. If we have those in abundance, it eliminates any threat of biological warfare.
Okay, so your tools can work for the defense as fast as for the attack,
yep,
so to speak. We're going to have one more question. It's Larry Page. Do you have your hand up? Did I see that? Yeah.
I guess I'm interested in the how efficient you think the photosynthesis or the CO2-based energy systems can be based on life.
Well, it's a good question and an important one. I mean, what we see with organisms like Methanococcus, CO2 is their source of carbon. So every bit of carbon in that cell is derived from CO2. What we see with plants is not very efficient. What we see with algae is much more efficient. So if we engineer algae using sunlight and CO2 and engineer the organisms like Methanococcus, we could actually use the combination of those to run day and night in a pretty efficient fashion, capturing CO2. The limitation, interestingly, is going to be CO2 for this process because we can't just capture it out of the air. It's not high enough concentration. But CO2 sequestration, where people have been talking about dumping it into coal beds and oil beds, instead we think we can take that stream, convert it back into fuel, changing the equation in real time. So we need high concentrations of CO2 to drive this process. So it's we need to drive the CO2 sequestration industry in parallel with this.
So finally, Craig, I just wanted to ask almost a more personal question about how you, you know, think of your own legacy in this. I mean, you must lie awake some nights just thinking, you know, how did this happen? How was it me who was put in a position where potentially could, you know, materially alter the future of the human race, you know, create this new explosion of life forms, whatever. This is a big deal. I mean, how
do you scare people? I don't think those things.
But
think about the potential of what we're trying to do. We were at Davos. I got very depressed being at Davos this year because it was clear most of the business executives that were there sort of buy into the CO2 issue is a pain for them. The consensus was nothing's going to change in the next 40 years because of vested interests. It was pretty discouraging. So I worry much more whether these technologies and others that people here are developing can get out there in time to make a difference. We're playing a hell of an experiment with this planet that worries me more than any other aspect.
So when you first came to TED and I asked you, couldn't you be accused of playing God? And you said, oh, we're not playing. it was a great joke, you know, or was it?
Well, we're not playing, for sure. And I think it's part of the ethical review that we had. Most major religions were brought in. It's part of most religions to actually play God. You're supposed to use your knowledge to improve humanity. So I think it depends on who's making the accusation. If it's religions, then it's a good thing. But we think this is science at its best, not religion. I think the one thing that could kill this are the ideas that were just mentioned, that this is so scary we shouldn't do it. We shouldn't try and solve these problems this way. I think public acceptance, which is why I spend time talking to the public, is as important as the quality of the science. We saw that in Europe with GMOs. I joke that Europeans now want DNA-free food. We need real solutions. I think if people listen to this pessimistic view that came out of Davos, the urgency is not really there. We don't see it, and I think that's how this community can help the most.
Craig Venter, what you're doing is astonishing. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. Thank you.
It's unbelievable. Thank you. So here we are. Thank you, Craig Venter. Approaching an epical choice. Do we open life up to unleash its mystical power and in the process open a Pandora's box of life on Earth? Or do we not and struggle onward like fish in a drying pond, trying to adapt quickly enough to learn to walk? For most people on Earth, they will be going along for the ride. But for many of us, we will be driving the bus, building the bus, on the bus, and it's a long, mysterious, unknown road upward. Some of you will want to start now to understand the work of Craig Venter, and you can listen to his introductory lecture, which showcases the science that brings us to this moment in segment 3 of today's show. So make your choice. We'll be continuing today's show, and everyone's welcome to come along as we do each week on the most important 15 minutes on Earth, the weekly Earth Summit. So here we go with the rest of the show. In a few moments in segment 2, you'll hear about fieldstudies.org, which is providing hands-on field study classes to college students in special field study sites around the world. That's coming up following the weekly Nature News, which begins right now. So now, the news. Researchers from British Antarctic Survey say they have discovered that a group of glaciers about the size of Texas is flowing into the ocean at an accelerated rate this past year. Based on this new information, predictions of as much as a 10-inch rise in the oceans within the next 2 decades seems possible. South African wildlife officials say that culling the country's elephants later this year will be necessary to dampen a population that is now out of control. Since management of elephant populations has begun, their numbers have increased from 8,000 to 18,000. The World Wildlife Fund and other environmental groups acknowledge that culling is called for due to limited habitat. Rob Little of WWF said, and I quote, "We all love our elephants. They are the most charismatic icon of Africa. But we don't have the luxury to allow one species to dominate and alter the composition of our natural assets," unquote. As elephants have been recorded mourning the death of a family member, whole families will be taken down to eliminate unnecessary suffering. Following yet another dramatic open sea struggle, Captain Paul Watson and his ship, the Steve Irwin, are heading home from their 17-day battle with the Japanese whaling fleet. Within the last few days, during an intense skirmish between crews of the Nishan Maru and the Steve Irwin, in which stink bottles and flash grenades were being exchanged, Captain Watson was shot in the chest. Here now is Captain Watson talking about the incident.
We had a confrontation with the Japanese vessel Nishan Maru, and we were putting stink bombs on the deck, you know, and rotten butter. And they retaliated with flash grenades, and which injured two of my crew. And then I felt a thud in my chest, and I found out I was struck by a bullet and was lodged in my Kevlar vest. And the Japanese government's acknowledged that they did fire shots during the incident. That I got hit in the chest, and two of my crew members were injured.
Captain Watson estimates that the efforts of the Steve Irwin, Sea Shepherd's primary chase vessel, has saved over 500 whales. The Japanese continue their annual research run into the Arctic seas, during which they generally kill over 1,000 whales for research, which eventually ends up in fine Japanese restaurants. Canadian residents are demanding a recount of annual snowfall this winter, as they believe a new record amount of snow has fallen. So far, 13.4 feet of snow has fallen on Ottawa this winter, 8 inches shy of the all-time record set nearly 70 years ago. Some residents are saying, bring it on, while others claim satisfaction with coming in second. As winter continues to hammer areas of North America, that record may be finalized within the next few weeks. Leaders of the influential Southern Baptist community in the U.S. have declared their church's duty to address climate change. In a joint statement signed by 40 leaders entitled A Southern Baptist Declaration on the Environment and Climate Change, the mission became clear, and I quote, "We believe our current denominational engagement with these issues has often been too timid. Our cautious response in the face of mounting evidence may be seen by the world as uncaring, reckless, and ill-informed. We can do better," unquote. And finally, the founder of the Weather Channel, TV weatherman John Coleman, says it's time to set the record straight about the, quote, fraud of global warming, unquote. He's prepared to go to court to make his case. His lawsuit targets Al Gore and carbon credit traders to make his point, which he claims is part of, quote, the greatest scam in history. Coleman includes, amongst his many accomplishments, the Coleman screech, one of the most annoying sounds in the animal kingdom, which he squeals out randomly during his evening forecast. Living in the Ocean City of San Diego, California, depending on how long his case drifts in the courts, evidence may in fact float its way into the courtroom during high tides in the years ahead. And that's the news. If you're in college and would like to learn field study techniques in the jungles, savannas, and oceans around the world, get out your field notebook, sharpen your pencil, and get ready to take some notes. That's coming up when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Okay, all you wannabe field huggers, here's a badass way to chill and wind your mind around making it better, getting out and stretching your skills to become a certified real earth warrior. Or, want to head off to an exotic place to learn to do field studies as part of your college degree? Take a walk on the wild side. News, that is, coming up in less than it takes to recharge your iPod. I love doing field work. I've done plenty of it as a naturalist, working in state and national parks and contract work at different times. There's nothing like being in a natural place, surrounded by time and sunlight or rain, dressed for the occasion, field notebook, binoculars, camera, and whatever specialized equipment you need to go in-depth with one aspect of how our planet works. If that sounds like something you'd like to do, then let's get started. As far as I can tell, this seems to be a new era for nature, which is exciting because I think for quite a while, it almost seems as if nature fell off the radar screen far too much as all these new technologies and gizmos and the modern era just kind of marched right in front of all the wonders and extraordinary aspects of nature. And also with all of the challenges that are facing the planet right now in so many different ways with global warming and extinction of animals, depletion of the oceans, and on, thank goodness people are beginning to realize that we simply have to really learn what's going on and then make some fundamental differences. But the best way to do that is to really get down and learn. And there's about only one real way to do that, and that's to go out into the field and do the research. For those people who've had the great opportunity to do that, it's one of the most amazing things in the world. If you haven't done it, you need to. And that's why we're talking with Terry Andreas now, who joins us from New York City. Terry, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you.
Well, when I talk about field studies, you're really a person that knows what I'm talking about. Why don't you give us an introduction to fieldstudies.org?
Well, I probably know more about teaching it than doing it, as I'm not a scientist myself. I'm also not a teacher. I just participated in inventing the School for Field Studies about 28 years ago. And largely then I was interested in how fast you can learn about something, or anyone can learn about something, when they're actually doing it. So if you go out into, say, a national park, and they've told you that their problem this week or this year is that last year 100,000 people came to visit it, and this year 2 million want to visit it, where should they start? I mean, and the first thing you do is figure out that the dirt roads, the dirt paths, they're not going to make it.
Mm-hmm.
So we've found that we can teach college students how to do field research when they're much more easily when they're doing real, honest, usable research for other people that they've met. And so it's a good thing for everybody to go into a community, even their own community, and take a look around at what they see, because we all care that we're going to be able to drink the water in 15 years.
Well, this is a really wonderful program, and I believe it's geared primarily to college students, although now is it open to people out of college as well?
Well, we have a graduate program in the summer in public health that has took place the first one last year in Kenya, or the first two. And this year, we don't know if it'll work in Kenya or not. We've moved our Kenya wildlife program to Tanzania, but we are branching out to some graduate courses. We like to do graduate students, and we have a couple of high school courses in the summertime. I think that one is in Baja California.
One of the things I think is really interesting, and I encourage people to go to the website at fieldstudies.org, and I'm going to spell that, fieldstudies.org. You've been at this for quite some time. You say 23 years?
28.
28 years. Well, there you go, five more. You really have focused on primarily about five or six study countries. You're really on the ground there, and you've really established yourself. Why don't you, first of all, inform people about where most of your studies are taking place these days?
Well, they're usually in Kenya, right now Tanzania, Australia, Costa Rica, Baja California, and Turks and Caicos, which is a group of islands just north of the Dominican Republic.
Now, in terms of let's just talk about Costa Rica for a second. It gives people an idea of what's involved. Let's say a student wants to learn about field studies through your courses and they want to go to Costa Rica. How do they sort of apply?
Actually, the easiest way is to go to the website, fieldstudies.org. The application is online. The descriptions of the courses are online. And what we're doing there is assisting the government in literally what I was talking about before, what to do about their national parks, because their largest moneymaker in the country is now tourism, rather than coffee or pineapple or any of the things they used to major in, if you will. So they really need to know how to keep their national parks up, and they love them. There are lots and lots of really good national parks in the whole country.
I can recall years ago, I had a friend of mine who was involved in setting up a lot of those programs, and it was an exciting opportunity to really plant a huge green seed in the middle of Central America that is bearing fruit right now. So if a person goes to the Costa Rica site, are they staying in tents, or are they backpacking, or what's the situation there?
No, we have a dormitory. It was originally, 20 years ago, or maybe 15 years ago, a chalk factory, but it is a rather wonderful dormitory with a laboratory right in it, a big classroom, and an area to sort of lounge in. There's actually a television set, but I don't think it gets TV programs. They use it for videos. The lab is there. The library is there. The computer usage is there. And the rest of the area around the dormitory is little casitas that the professors live in on campus, on site, and a working farm, which raises mostly mangoes, oranges. They drink all their own orange juice. There is a medicinal herb garden there, collecting things from the local housewives, and a farmer on site, as you might imagine, to keep the thing going. It's quite beautiful. It's at the top of a cliff overlooking a river called the Rio Grande. I think every Central American country has one. And they leave from there to go to the national parks, but not every day. I mean, they design their own research, they work with the teachers, so they're doing a whole semester worth of courses, a semester's credit worth of courses.
I think that's an interesting part of this, too, and an important aspect, and that's that you're spending real time there.
Yes.
Okay, it's not some of the ecotourism projects will get you out there for, 5 days, 10 days, but this is really a semester-long project, so tell us about the commitment.
Well, it's 14 weeks, and it's accredited through not only Boston University, unless you attend one of our affiliate colleges. I think there's 73 of those. And you do a whole semester of courses, exams, papers, and presentations. Everything the students do in their small teams is, in the end, presented to the community or to the client, often, in this case, someone from the National Park, the head of the National Park Service. They also present things to the town when we do water issues research. They end up presenting their findings to the town council. They also participate in the local schools. We do a lot of environmental teaching in elementary schools, taking what we learned in their community to the children who live there.
That's a great, great opportunity.
So the students get a lot of local involvement, and they love it. I mean, the town loves it, we love it, and it's fun. We have parties.
Yeah. In terms of participating, what's the criteria for selecting students?
Well, I think it's not specific. There has to be a reasonable grade level, and they have to have had some courses in environmental studies of some sort, because otherwise the language is too complicated, the language of scientific research. I mean, you would know that.
Yes.
So they have to be familiar with the language. We used to ask them, please, to have had statistics, but we found that we have to teach that ourselves now.
No, I don't think that's a big popular topic these days. I guess if you're serious about science, you best get into statistics, but I think for the general people who have an interest, that's not going to be one of their curriculum.
Well, what you find is if you want to do research, you become interested in the statistics that analyze what it is you found out.
Sure.
So it's easier to learn when you want to know it, which is one of our premises. And if you really want to know about something, I mean, like how to make chocolate chip cookies out of a third of a bag of chocolate chips, multiply by a third.
Now, that's applied statistics for sure. I'd be curious in terms of the areas of focus. I know field research has so many dynamics. You've got plants, animals, doing taxonomic studies. There's so many different variables. I'm just curious, what's the focus of some of your studies there? Because you can't cover everything, but you certainly, I'm sure, are focused on a variety of things.
Right. Well, we talked about Costa Rica, where we also do water issues. But the other ones, in Kenya, we're looking at the interaction between large animals and the people who live there.
Mm.
And the conflict there is, do you work for a tourist bureau or sell things to the tourists, which would make you want to have lots of animals, large wild animals, or do you raise cows, which might make you want to have all the water for your cows? And there's a conflict like that all over Africa. So we look at the interaction. We don't take a side, but we try to get the people in the area to discuss it. We also look at elephant issues with Cynthia Moss in Amboseli in Kenya. We've moved all of our animal studies, as you know, for political reasons to Tanzania at this time, and we don't really know what's going to happen there. But that's what we do in Kenya. In Australia, there's been a long-term drought there, but we do issues on rainforest studies. And there we're looking at the effects of the drought, at reestablishing rainforest areas in a secondary area. We're up in Queensland, which is just inland from Cairns and not far from Douglaston. But we're up on the Atherton Tableland. They're interested in maintaining their rainforest areas and the creatures that live in it in that particular part of the world. In Turks and Caicos, they have 13 underwater national heritage parks. We're trying to help them figure out how to maintain it. We looked at lobster catch. We do a little bit of population count. They're generally underwater issues.
I was looking through your website. You talked about the fact that people, they're going to be spending a lot of time in the water, so they need to think about snorkeling, but as well may have to come prepared to do some scuba, or at least that's an option for them.
Yes, it is.
What a beautiful way to do field research.
Yeah, it is. It's beautiful. A baby whale visited our center a couple of summers ago.
Oh, my goodness.
While they were underwater.
Well, after 28 years at this, I'm sure there's been some moments, some exciting moments. Any that come to mind that you think tell a particularly provocative story?
Well, my favorite student accident, fortunately, we've been very fortunate with our students. We've done very well over all the years and come out healthy. We have a safety director, and we visit the safety issues at the board level all the time. But my favorite student accident was a young man a long time ago who ran too fast out of his banda in Kenya and ran into a giraffe's leg. He got himself a big goose egg on his head, but it took his fellow students a little while to figure out what he had hit.
That's funny, because, of course, the giraffe is gone by this time.
Well, he didn't go very far, because he was quite a tame giraffe.
Oh, that's fun. That's fun. You also work, as you say, for example, in Kenya or now Tanzania, with large animals, a lot of large wildlife studies. Talk about some of the ways in which you're working with them. That sounds fascinating. I know, for example, there's been a story just recently, I think is very controversial, where some of the elephant management programs in various areas of Africa have been so successful that they're now beginning to cull the animals. And it's I haven't done the research to really find out what I think about that. I think generally I don't like the concept of killing elephants because they are such family animals and such communal animals.
Yes.
That it seems to me that could traumatize the herd. But just your thoughts. Have you been following that story at all?
I see it from time to time. It's very painful to even think about it. Students certainly discuss it. We don't generally come to conclusions. I mean, I certainly wouldn't want to kill a single one of them. But then you have to talk to the people who live there whose farms have been crushed and talk about, can they have birth control for the elephant? And maybe that should be a big game sport, you know?
Hmm. Interesting. Go out with your...
Starting and sterilizing an elephant, or at least temporarily.
Wow.
I mean, I don't know. It's an awful subject.
Unfortunately, these are the things that in the real world we're having to deal with.
Yep, these are the interactions between wildlife and humans, yeah.
There's been in many cases, some great success stories. And sometimes those success stories have a backlash effect, and I guess that's what we're learning. That's where these field studies come in so well. I would guess as well a lot of your work really is useful in terms of creating baseline studies for areas, which are critical in terms of measuring change through time.
Well, it is. And some places we're sort of unaware that, or we were until last summer, that Kenya didn't even have a population count, the area in which my public health students were working. So essentially, in vaccinating the women and the children who came into the public health clinic, you could count the population. And the government of Kenya had no idea what the population was in that area. So we just furnished that to the government, and it's a very useful service just to count the people.
Human baseline studies.
Yes.
That's fundamental.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. You're also working in Mexico. Also, I think in Mexico you offer a high school program. Most of your work is for college students, and then you have a few graduate courses, but as well you offer a summer course.
Yes, they're looking at the turtle issues in Baja. A lot of turtles lay their eggs there, and the water issues, and the fact that the population is growing really, really fast there, and it's customary to eat turtles. So there's another human-animal interaction.
Well, that's become a huge issue because that's where the turtles lay their eggs.
It is.
And if people just continue to destroy the eggs, there's dramatic... Well, you know more about this than I do because you're down there all the time.
Yes, but if they don't eat the eggs and eat the turtles, the tourists come and spend money in their town. So there is a point to letting them know, letting the town know how valuable these turtles and their egg-laying habits are to the town.
Oh, that's fascinating. There's so many different things we could talk about, but one of the things I'd be certainly interested in, you know, the concept of the economic values of ecotourism versus the traditional forms of timber harvesting, mineral harvesting, etc. How is that playing out in the field there, literally in the field, and that's what you're doing a lot of your studies about?
It's absolutely fascinating to the students because as much as they love turtles or elephants or whatever when they come, they do learn that, you know, life is about shades of gray. Nothing is perfect. The decision-making we all have to do our whole life on one thing or another. So this is an introduction to it in a way that interests them and in a way that they can make a positive contribution to the interactions of animals and humans by informing the people of how life really is, how much money they're making from these people who come stay in their hotels and rent their boats and use their beaches.
Of course, in some respects, that's an invasion of non-indigenous species, and that has its own effects.
Yes, it is. Yeah, that's a very good point.
Mm-hmm. And that's something that concerns me, is the preservation of diversity of cultures. I think that's a very, very important issue. So there's trade-offs everywhere. You know, there really are. In terms of the scheduling for your classes, when are your semesters scheduled?
Late September to early December, end of January to May. There are two 5-week courses at each center in the summertime, and the public health courses are in the summer. About June to middle of July to the end of August.
Now, there's a fee, and it's a pretty hefty fee. Maybe that's not the right term for it, but some people will go, my gosh, because I'll just mention a rough figure, about $15,000. But that does include, outside of the airfare, it includes all of the course study, living accommodations, food, and travel within the country.
Yes, we also have a lot of scholarships.
Oh, excellent.
And so you can just talk to the admissions people or go online and correspond with them. There are a lot of scholarships. There are a lot of scholarships, especially for people at public colleges or public universities, that are specially set aside because their tuitions are so different. Our tuition is about the same as a private college,
right?
Without the room and board.
I'm older than some of my listeners, and I can remember when tuition was like $120 a quarter.
I know.
Yeah.
Me too.
Those were good days. I remember that.
We had a lot of money then, though.
We did. It was a glory time. It was truly the good days. Yeah. And it's hard for me to understand how people manage these days with the cost of tuition. It's really astonishing.
It's astounding.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah. So I think your fees are comparable to what people are accustomed to paying, you know, in regular universities.
It's also a nonprofit. I mean, we're not in it for the money. Not charging anything extra.
Well, it sounds absolutely fascinating. And after 28 years, what actually brought you to doing this? You mentioned that you're not really trained as a scientist, so how did you come about getting into operating fieldstudies.org?
Well, I have four grown children and several grandchildren, and it occurred to me as they were growing up, they were young teenagers or preteens when I started this with four friends in Boston, and it was obvious to me that if you could exhibit to them why you had to learn, say, fractions and how it was useful to you, that they learned it really fast. And we were all talking in Boston at dinner one night, and four of us got together and tried out, before we ever started this organization, an experiential learning course. We took 14-year-olds, which was seriously, we decided it was a mistake. We needed older students. And then we evolved it. I mean, the year before we opened it, I went to Africa to watch a survival trainer, a Harvard professor, and 17 students do experiments on heat, light, and rhinoceros. And these kids picked up the language in a heartbeat. They were fascinated with it, so they learned it right away. And so we decided to try it. At first, the first 5 years, it was just the summer, and then we decided it was just the same amount of effort to recruit students for summer as for winter, we might as well do it. That way we could hire people year-round and not have to rehire every summer. Anyway, mm-hmm. It evolved.
Well, what a great project. This has really, I'm sure, embellished your life in untold ways.
It's been really fun. And all my kids had to go.
There you go. You're also involved in some other interesting projects.
Oh, let's see. I'm a trustee at Boston University. I always thought that was because they wanted to make sure I was sane. Keep an eye on me. just because they were going to accredit. And I work with the Coalition for the Homeless here in New York, which is the same amount of work all the time because things aren't getting that much better. And I'm the president of my co-op board, which is very, it's like being mayor of a small town and kind of fun. And that's kind of enough.
Well, it seems to me you have something to do with birds.
Uptown birds, yes. My partner Daniel Koplis and I opened a pet shop 3 months ago. So I've always wanted a pet shop since I was a little girl. And Daniel was a friend who took care of my birds. And one day he said he had opened pet shops in Tennessee, and I said, oh, I always wanted to do that. If you ever want to do it again, tell me. And a few months later, he said, you know, I'd like to open a pet shop. So we did. It took us 2 years, but we wanted a beautiful shop with parrots that weren't in cages, so they're not jailed. So we have about a 10-foot in diameter glass aviary where the birds live. And we raise them ourselves with our staff from the time they're hatchlings so that they're very tame. I mean, they come land on your head whenever you walk in. They like people. And so we have a collection of parrots, and I go to the pet shop as often as I can. It's so peaceful. We also have saltwater fish and freshwater fish, small reptiles like bearded dragons, who are adorable, and a few little furry animals, and some grown-up ones. People have brought us, for example, an adult veiled chameleon who is gorgeous. And she's about 7 inches long, and her tongue is as long as she is. Lots of those caterpillars. But it's a wonderful exotic pet shop.
As you know, I've talked with Daniel, and it was really a very wonderful conversation. I get to New York on occasion.
Terrific.
And I'm going to stop by and say hello. And why don't you also tell people again one more time how they can find out more about fieldstudies.org.
www.fieldstudies.org. You can email there, too. It's easy to find on the web.
Terry Andreas, thanks so much. Great work. I look forward to meeting with you, and let's talk again on the Wild Side News.
It's a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much, Sydney.
It's a fascinating world, and that's what we explore and report on each week. You can always come here when you want. Explore the archives. Just listen around and hear what life is really all about. We do this every week. Thanks for coming along. Now, some of you may want to hang on for segment 3, in which Dr. Craig Venter goes scientific about his success in synthesizing life. And for those who need to move along, wishing you all the good stuff. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again next Tuesday or any time on the archives when your voice of the earth rings out around the world here on the Wild Side News. This is one of the greatest things about internet radio. We can stretch it out to fit your needs anytime, and that's what we do now. As we present to you part one of Dr. Craig Venter's address at TED, in which he provides the pathways that have led him to announce the future of synthetic life. So now, Dr. Craig Venter.
You know, I've talked about some of these projects before, about the human genome and what that might mean, and discovering new sets of genes. We're actually starting at a new point. We've been digitizing biology, and now we're trying to go from that digital code into a new phase of biology with designing and synthesizing life. So we've always been trying to ask big questions. What is life is something that I think many biologists have been trying to understand at various levels. We've tried various approaches, paring it down to minimal components. We've been digitizing it now for almost 20 years when we sequenced the human genome. It was going from the analog world of biology into the digital world of the computer. Now we're trying to ask, can we regenerate life, or can we create new life out of this digital universe? This is the map of a small organism, Mycoplasma genitalium, that has the smallest genome for a species that can self-replicate in the laboratory. And we've been trying to just see if we can come up with an even smaller genome. We're able to knock out on the order of 100 genes out of the 500 or so that are here. But when we look at its metabolic map, it's relatively simple compared to ours. Trust me, this is simple. But when we look at all the genes that we can knock out one at a time, it's very unlikely that this would yield a living cell. So we decided the only way forward was to actually synthesize this chromosome so we could vary the components to ask some of these most fundamental questions. And so we started down the road of, can we synthesize a chromosome? Can chemistry permit making these really large molecules where we've never been before? And if we do, can we boot up a chromosome? A chromosome, by the way, is just a piece of inert chemical material. So our pace of digitizing life has been increasing at an exponential pace. Our ability to write the genetic code has been moving pretty slowly, but has been increasing, and our latest point would put it on now an exponential curve. We started this over 15 years ago. It took several stages, in fact, starting with a bioethical review before we did the first experiments. But it turns out synthesizing DNA is very difficult. There's tens of thousands of machines around the world that make small pieces of DNA, 30 to 50 letters in length. And it's a degenerate process, so the longer you make the piece, the more errors there are. So we had to create a new method for putting these little pieces together and correct all the errors. And this was our first attempt, starting with the digital information of the genome of PHYX174. It's a small virus that kills bacteria. We designed the pieces, went through our error correction, and had a DNA molecule of about 5,000 letters. The exciting phase came when we took this piece of inert chemical and put it in the bacteria. And the bacteria started to read this genetic code, made the viral particles. The viral particles then were released from the cells and came back and killed the E. coli. I was talking to the oil industry recently, and I said they clearly understood that model. They laugh more than you guys are. And so we think this is a situation where the software can actually build its own hardware in a biological system. But we wanted to go much larger. We wanted to build the entire bacterial chromosome. It's over 580,000 letters of genetic code. So we thought we'd build them in cassettes the size of the viruses so we could actually vary the cassettes to understand what the actual components of a living cell are. Design is critical, and if you're starting with digital information in the computer, that digital information has to be really accurate. When we first sequenced this genome in 1995, the standard of accuracy was one error per 10,000 base pairs. We actually found on resequencing it 30 errors. Had we used that original sequence, it never would have been able to be booted up. Part of the design is designing pieces that are 50 letters long that have to overlap with all the other 50 letter pieces to build smaller subunits. We have to design so they can go together. We design unique elements into this. You may have read that we put watermarks in. Think of this. We have a four-letter genetic code, A, C, G, and T. Triplets of that letters of those letters code for roughly 20 amino acids, that there's a single letter designation for each of the amino acids. So we can use the genetic code to write out words, sentences, thoughts. Initially, all we did was autograph it. Some people were disappointed there was not poetry. We design these pieces so we can just chew back with enzymes. There's enzymes that repair them and put them together. And we started making pieces, starting with pieces that were 5,000 to 7,000 letters, put those together to make 24,000 letter pieces, then put sets of those going up to 72,000. At each stage, we grew up these pieces in abundance so we could sequence them, because we're trying to create a process that's extremely robust that you can see in a minute. We're trying to get to the point of automation. So this looks like a basketball playoff. When we get into these really large pieces, over 100,000 base pairs, they won't any longer grow readily in E. coli. It exhausts all the modern tools of molecular biology, and so we turned to other mechanisms. We knew there's a mechanism called homologous recombination that biology uses to repair DNA that can put pieces together. Here's an example of it. There's an organism called Deinococcus radiodurans that can take 3 million rads of radiation. You can see in the top panel, its chromosome just gets blown apart. 12 to 24 hours later, it put it back together exactly as it was before. We have thousands of organisms that can do this. These organisms can be totally desiccated. They can live in a vacuum. I am absolutely certain that life can exist in outer space, move around, find a new aqueous environment. In fact, NASA has shown a lot of this is out there. Here's an actual micrograph of the molecule we built using these processes, actually just using yeast mechanisms with the right design of the pieces we put them in. Yeast puts them together automatically. This is not an electron micrograph. This is just a regular photomicrograph. It's such a large molecule, we can see it with a light microscope. These are pictures over about a six-second period. So this is the publication we had just a short while ago. This is over 580,000 letters of genetic code. It's the largest molecule ever made by humans of a defined structure. It's over 300 million molecular weight. If we print it out at a 10 font with no spacing, it takes 142 pages just to print this genetic code. Well, how do we boot up a chromosome? How do we activate this? Obviously, with a virus, it's pretty simple. It's much more complicated dealing with bacteria. It's also simpler when you go into eukaryotes like our cells. You can just pop out the nucleus and pop in another one, and that's what you've all heard about with cloning. With bacteria and archaea, the chromosome is integrated into the cell. But we recently showed that we can do a complete transplant of a chromosome from one cell to another and activate it. We purified a chromosome from one microbial species. Roughly, these two are as distant as human and mice. We added a few extra genes so we could select for this chromosome. We digested it with enzymes to kill all the proteins. And it was pretty stunning when we put this in the cell, and you'll appreciate our very sophisticated graphics here. The new chromosome went into the cell. In fact, we thought this might be as far as it went, but we tried to design the process a little bit further. This is a major mechanism of evolution right here. We find all kinds of species that have taken up a second chromosome or a third one from somewhere, adding thousands of new traits in a second to that species. So people who think of evolution as just one gene changing at a time have missed much of biology. There's enzymes called restriction enzymes that actually digest DNA. The chromosome that was in the cell doesn't have one. The chromosome we put in does. It got expressed and it recognized the other chromosome as foreign material, chewed it up. And so we ended up just with the cell with the new chromosome. It turned blue because of the genes we put in it. And with a very short period of time, all the characteristics of one species were lost, and it converted totally into the new species based on the new software that we put in the cell. All the proteins changed. The membranes changed. When we read the genetic code, it's exactly what we had transferred in. So this may sound like genomic alchemy, but we can, by moving the software of DNA around, change things quite dramatically. Now, I've argued this is not Genesis. This is building on 3.5 billion years of evolution. And I've argued that we're about to perhaps create a new version of the Cambrian explosion, where there's massive new speciation based on this digital design. Why do this? I think this is pretty obvious in terms of some of the needs. We're about to go from 6.5 to 9 billion people over the next 40 years. To put it in context for myself, I was born in 1946. There's now 3 people on the planet for every one of us that existed in 1946. Within 40 years, there'll be 4. We have trouble feeding, providing fresh, clean water, medicines, fuel for the 6.5 billion. It's going to be stretched to do it for 9. We use over 5 billion tons of coal, 30 billion plus barrels of oil. That's 100 million barrels a day. When we try to think of biological processes or any process to replace that, it's going to be a huge challenge. Then, of course, there's all that CO2 from this material that ends up in the atmosphere. We now, from our discovery around the world, have a database with about 20 million genes. And I like to think of these as the design components of the future. The electronics industry only had a dozen or so components, and look at the diversity that came out of that. We're limited here primarily by a biological reality and our imagination. We now have techniques, because of these rapid methods of synthesis, to do what we're calling combinatorial genomics. We have the ability now to build a large robot that can make 1 million chromosomes a day. When you think of processing these 20 million different genes, or trying to optimize processes to produce octane or to produce pharmaceuticals, new vaccines, we can change just with a small team, do more molecular biology than the last 20 years of all science. And it's just standard selection. We can select for viability, chemical or fuel production, vaccine production, etc. This is a screen snapshot of some true design software that we're working on to actually be able to sit down and design species in the computer. You know, we don't know necessarily what we look like. We know exactly what their genetic code looks like. We're focusing on now a fourth generation fuels. You've seen recently corn to ethanol is just a bad experiment. We have second and third generation fuels that will be coming out relatively soon that are sugar to much higher value fuels like octane or different types of butanol. But the only way we think that biology can have a major impact without further increasing the cost of food and limiting its availability is if we start with CO2 as its feedstock. And so we're working with designing cells to go down this road, and we think we'll have the first fourth generation fuels in about 18 months. Sunlight and CO2 is one method. But in our discovery around the world, we have all kinds of other methods. This is an organism we described in 1996. It lives in the deep ocean, about 1.5 miles deep, almost at boiling water temperatures. It takes CO2 to methane using molecular hydrogen as its energy source. We're looking to see if we can take captured CO2, which can easily be piped to sites, convert that CO2 back into fuel to drive this process. So in a short period of time, we think that we might be able to increase what the basic question is of what is life. We're truly, you know, have modest goals of replacing the whole petrochemical industry. You know, if you can't do that at TED, where can you? Become a major source of energy. But also, we're now working on using these same tools to come up with instant sets of vaccines. You've seen this year with flu. We're always a year behind and a dollar short when it comes to the right vaccine. I think that can be changed by building combinatorial vaccines in advance. Here's what the future may begin to look like with changing now the evolutionary tree, speeding up evolution with synthetic bacteria, archaea, and eventually eukaryotes. We're a ways away from improving people. Our goal is just to make sure that we have a chance to survive long enough to maybe do that. Thank you very much.
If you'd like more information on Dr. Venter's work, Google Craig Venter. To hear the follow-up Q&A with Dr. Venter, restart segment one of today's show. And be sure to visit us each week here on Wild Side News. Thank you.